So many things to be praying about. I think we could have spent the whole time just praying this morning because of all the things going on. The writer of Hebrews declares that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And he goes on to tell us that people of old, not necessarily old people, but people of old, that's people in the Old Testament times, were commended for their faith in God. However, as I think about it, and I think about trusting God and what that means in my life and such, I find that it's often difficult to trust God, that it's often hard to trust Him. I find by nature that I tend towards doubt and fear. Just naturally, my mind goes that way in situations, thinking, oh, everything is going to turn out badly, all is lost, and just being afraid of the future at times. We tend to question God's ability, His care, and His wisdom in what He is doing. You know, in the scriptures, as we look at people wrestling with faith, and especially times of crises of faith, when there's something big being asked of them by God, we find that they don't all just stand up and say, "Yes, Lord, here am I, send me. I'm ready to go." They actually struggle. And the scriptures are really honest when it tells us about these struggles of people responding to God's call, God's leading in their life. So it is this kind of mixed bag in the scriptures. There are stories of great victory, but also stories that end in defeat, where people back down and aren't willing to follow the Lord. And that is difficult. But they are honest struggles. And if you are one who has ever struggled to trust the Lord in doing His will, then you have something in common with people in the Bible, and specifically with a person we're going to talk about this morning, because he was a man of wavering faith. One of the most difficult people, I think, in the scriptures to understand. His name is Gideon, and we find his story in the book of Judges in chapters 6 and 7. So if you have your Bibles, please turn to the book of Judges. Now, Judges is real easy to find because it's the seventh book, right? We all know that. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, and then Judges. And I bet you're thinking, the book of Judges, well, I've never read that. What is that about? And so I got this. I didn't make this. I copied this. But anyway, this is the best I could find. But this is really helpful, see? Because over here, you've got the things in Genesis and then the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then we know that at the end of Genesis, they go into slavery, right? And they're in slavery in Egypt for a long time. And then God raises up someone to help them. Moses leads them out of Egypt, the Exodus. And then Moses dies, and the leadership is turned over to Joshua. But then Joshua dies. And then we have right here the period of the Judges, the book of Judges, these and a whole bunch more people. And so the book of Judges takes place right between Moses and Joshua and then the kings. Saul, David, and Solomon, they reign over the united Israel, but not long. And it's only for that really their reigns that it's united. And then it breaks into two, Israel to the north and Judah to the south, with eventually both have a lot of trouble and get exiled by the Assyrians and then by the Babylonians. In the north and the south, and the whole thing falls apart. It just falls apart because of sin. But it's right here is what we're talking about, the period of the Judges. And if you read the book of Judges, well, first of all, let me say this. The name Judges is kind of is probably not the best name, I would say, because it's not a book about guys in black gowns sitting behind large benches with gavels in their hands. Now, when I think of a judge, that's what kind of comes to my mind, you know, guilty, not guilty, overruled, those kinds of things. So judges say. But that's not at all what we're talking about in the book of Judges. The book of Judges, it's rather a book about a number of deliverers who God raises up, and then they kind of reign for a short time, and then they go back to what they're doing or they die. But they're not kings, but they're not legal judges either, per se. They're more so kind of temporary leaders that God raises up because of the constant trouble that Israel keeps getting, the people, God's people keep getting themselves into. And so this verse in Judges 2 kind of is a sample of that. It says there in Judges 2 that they abandoned the Lord. Again, this is after the leadership of Moses and Joshua, and they served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. These are the local deities of Canaan. And so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. But then the Lord raised up judges, and here's where we get the word for the book of Judges, who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. And we're going to see this happening in just a moment. So that's how we get this name. This is the thing that they're doing. And this, what happened, what we just read, happened really repeatedly during this time period. And when you read the book of Judges, you see this recurring cycle of events. And it goes like this. The people get into sin. Okay, they disobey God. Usually it involves idolatry. That seems to be the main thing, because you've got all these people around them saying, oh, come worship our God. Come over here and worship our deities, and it'll go well with you. And they say, well, you know, we can see your deities. We can't see ours. So maybe we should try yours. And they are constantly getting drawn into idolatry by the people living around them. And so they get into sin. Then they are oppressed by the people around them. God kind of hands them over. And then they cry out to the Lord, oh, Lord, save us. Save us from these people. The Lord then raises up a deliverer or a judge. They are saved. It's followed by a time of safety. And yes, then they go back into sin again. And this happens over and over again in the book of Judges. Now, the last verse in the book of Judges tells us why this kept happening. And it says, the very last verse of the book says, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Well, of course, that's going to be problems. If you don't have anyone giving strong leadership, which would include fidelity to the Lord and spiritual leadership, and if people are just doing what seems right to themselves without that leadership, they're going to constantly be straying into sin. And so that is what happened. And in Judges chapter 6 is where I want to look at this morning. This cycle has begun. So if you find the book of if you found Judges and if you found chapter 6, we're just going to look at some verses. Today. We're not going to read all of it completely. I don't have time for that. It's a long narrative about Gideon. But in Judges chapter 6, in verses, what's happened here, if you look at the first verse, the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian. And then he goes down in verse 4. They would, these Midianites and these Amalekites would encamp against them and devour the produce of the land as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance in Israel and no sheep or ox or donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, and they would come like locusts in number. Both they and their camels could not be counted, and so they laid waste the land as they came in. Well, that's not good. So what he's describing here is the people of Israel went into sin again, idolatry, it's going to be. And so God turned them over. And so the people, he turned them over to, just came in mass into the land and ate up the food and just devastated the land. Well, you can't live like that very long. You can't live like that very long at all. So, it says there then in verse 6, Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the people of Israel cried out for help to the Lord. And so this is the situation, and now the Lord intends to rescue them through Gideon. But Gideon isn't so sure about that. He doesn't know if that's really a good idea. His faith is not firm, and right from the start, he is questioning God's will. And so we look down in chapter 6, verse 11. Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth, which is just a kind of tree, at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress, and he was doing it there, and not where it should be done, to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor." And Gideon said to him, "Please, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his wonderful deeds that our fathers recounted to us, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and given us into the hand of Midian." And the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours and save Israel from the land of Midian. Do not I send you?" And he said to him, "Please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." And the Lord said to him, "But I will be with you, and you shall strike the Midianites as one man." And so the Lord appears to him through the angel of the Lord, and he says to this man, Gideon, "You are the man, O man of valor. And it is through you that I am going to save Israel." And immediately Gideon responds with a series of questions. And if you look at those questions, it's kind of interesting what he is asking about. And it is as if he is on the attack. He's blaming God for the situation. Look at verse 13. "My Lord, if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Lord, what is going on here?" And then he goes on to say that he has forsaken us. In the latter part of verse 13, why has the Lord forsaken us? Where is his saving power? Why has this happened to us? Well, that tells us something about Gideon. Gideon doesn't perceive that this has happened because the people have sinned. And Gideon isn't understanding that it's not the Lord who has forsaken the people, but it's the people who have forsaken the Lord. Now, it's not always the case. The Bible is clear about this. But there are times that God does judge or discipline his people because of their sins. Paul talks about the Corinthian church. Because of their behavior and the way they were sinning, he says in 1 Corinthians 11:30 that many are among you are sick or have died. And there Paul makes a direct connection between that judgment or discipline of the Lord upon them and their sin. But that's not always the case. We know that clearly from Scripture as well. But here, it is the case. It's because the people did what was evil in God's sight that God sent, allowed these people to come in. But Gideon doesn't perceive this. But this is what's interesting. Even though Gideon does not have that level of spiritual perception, God is still going to use him. And that's because God uses imperfect people, because that's all there is. That's all there is. We are all weak. We all have doubts. We all waver. We are all sometimes wondering about what God is doing, maybe even questioning him. Yet he puts a calling on all of our lives, even as he puts a calling on Gideon's life. Every one of us has a calling, not only to come to Christ, but also to serve the Lord in some way. It's related to our spiritual gifts, some ministry, some way of serving others. God has a calling for all of us. But Gideon, so we see here a glimpse of Gideon's lack of faith and lack of spiritual perception. But that's okay. But then in verse 15, he tells God what people often tell the Lord, that he's not qualified. I can't do this. And he says, how can I save Israel? I'm a nobody from an insignificant clan. And Lord, you should think about getting someone else. And it's interesting how common that occurs in the Bible. But I think people do this very same thing today. The very same thing. Oh, Lord, I can't do that. I can't do that. You better find someone else for that, Lord. And yet we know he's calling us to do it. We say, no, can't do it. Can't do it. But the Lord responds to this with basically saying this. Yes, Gideon, you're exactly right. You are the person specifically because you can't save Israel. I'm going to save Israel. And God often chooses the weak and the lesser, like he did, for instance, in the case of David, which many of you are familiar with. Paul talks about this as well. He chooses the people who aren't necessarily the ones you would think would be the one to rise up and be the deliverer. But in this case, and that's what he has here, he chooses a person who is really a nobody. And the reason he's going to do it is because what the angel says to him, I will be with you. And that's all that matters. That's all that matters. You realize that? When the Lord calls you to do something and you have the confidence that the Lord is with you, that's all that matters. Because it's not going to rely on your own personal strength. He will give you the gifts. He will give you the ability. He will give you the strength to do what he calls you to do. He's not going to say, okay, I want you to do this great thing. Now you go and figure it out. You do it in your own strength. You do it in your wisdom. In fact, we're going to see that it's the complete opposite that God is teaching Gideon in this account. And so Gideon is wavering here. But before we're done this morning, I think Gideon is going to begin to understand. He's going to learn that God is able and that he can be trusted. But right now he's not quite sure. He's not sure about that. He has a lot of doubts about that. But it's interesting, you see a progression in Gideon's life, I think. At least somewhat of an advancement. But it's not quite there yet. And so the Midianites and the Amalekites get into the land. They show up again in verse 33. Gideon has sent word to four of the northern tribes to come to Jezreel and fight them. And we see that in verse 35 of the text. And then in verse 36, it says this. Then Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you said, behold, I am laying a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece alone and it is dry on all the ground, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said. And it was so. When he rose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece, he wrung enough dew from the fleece to fill a bowl with water. Then Gideon said to God, "Let not your anger burn against me. Let me speak just once more. Please let me test just once more with the fleece. Please let it be dry on the fleece only, and all the ground let there be dew." And God did so that night, and it was dry on the fleece only, and on all the ground there was dew. So Gideon's not there yet. You've probably heard maybe about Gideon's fleece, right? This is a pretty common story from the Bible. He's still wondering, though, whether he can trust the Lord. But what about Gideon's fleece? What about this? You know, there are some believers who see this as a valid biblical means for discovering God's will. I've had people tell me that. Well, I'm just going to put out a fleece on this and see what the Lord says. What? That's in the Bible, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's what you should do. But people will put out various kind of fleeces. Maybe you've done that. You may have done that. You say, I gotta test this. Oh, okay. Now I gotta test it one more time to really make sure this is what the Lord has for me. It's a reflection of human nature, that doubting, that questioning that we have here. So in verse 37, I would just say this, that I would be very careful about doing that, first of all. I would just really be careful about doing this, because I don't at all think that this is what the Bible is teaching here. I don't think it's teaching us how to discern the will of God. Because the issue here is not what is God's will. That is not the issue. Don't think that it is for a moment. The whole exercise simply reveals his lack of faith and resistance to the call of God on his life. That's what this is showing us. And that's evident from what we read in the text. In verse 36, he admits that this is God's will, doesn't he? "If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said." Well, the Lord told him that. So it's not a question of what God's will is here at all. That's not it. That's crystal clear. The Lord said it. And Gideon knows that the Lord said it. In verse 37, he says, "Well, if the fleece is wet and the ground dry, I'll know this is your will." But even when that happens, even in God's grace, that happens, it's still not enough for him. It's still not good enough. We need to do it again. And because it might have somehow happened by chance, or there might be some other explanation for this. But we're going to do it again if we can, Lord, he says. And why is that? Because he doesn't want to accept this as God's will. He knows what God's will is. He just doesn't want to believe it. He doesn't want to embrace it. And then in verse 39, he also knows that this whole thing he's doing isn't pleasing to the Lord at all. Because he says, "Lord, don't be angry with me." Well, why would he say that? Because the Lord's probably getting angry with them. You know, there's limits, patience, all this sort of thing. Plus, there's that thing Moses said some time ago, "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test." Remember that? Jesus quoted that verse to the devil from the pinnacle of the temple. When the devil said to him, prove to me who you are, jump off here, and if you're truly the Son of God, you'll be safe. His angels will catch you. And Jesus said, "No, you don't put the Lord to the test. I'm not going to do that." So Gideon knows in his heart, I believe, that what he's doing here isn't pleasing to God. But he also has this doubt, this fear, this this things, these questions on the in part of his heart, his mind, that make it hard for him to embrace the will of God. And that's why he goes through this whole exercise with these fleeces. Not to find, not to discover the will of God. This is merely a way to show his resistance to the will of God. And so we see this, we still see that his faith is pretty unsteady. But we're rooting for him, aren't we? Come on, Gideon. Come on. Come on. We need to see you understand this. We need to see you come to a place of faith and trust. And I think we get a glimpse of some real faith in this last segment we're going to look at as his army is formed. Because he needs an army. And he's called them. Now he's going to form them up in some way. And so the Lord will give him some guidance in what follows in the passage and such. But before any of that, the Lord will insist that the size of his army be greatly reduced. And so we read here in chapter 7, verse 1. Then, let's see. Yep, this is what we want. Then Zerubbabel, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and camped beside the spring of Herod. And the camp of Midian was north of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, the people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand. Okay, now I would say, wait, Lord, stop there. Isn't a bigger army better than a smaller army? I mean, isn't it just normally? Isn't that what you want? Don't you want a bigger army? The more, the better? I mean, naturally, that's the way we think from a human point of view. And if I were Gideon, that's what I would have said. Wait. What's this talk about cutting back the army? I don't like that. But the Lord tells them the people are too many, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me. Now, therefore, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead. So Gideon gets up. Okay, I have an announcement. Anyone here afraid? All these hands go up. Okay, you can all go home. What? Go home? Yes, go home. And in that moment, Gideon's army is reduced from 32,000 people to 10,000 people. 22,000 people left. Now, I'd be a little nervous at that. If I'm Gideon, I'm standing there watching these, okay, you don't all have to go. You can, some of you can stay. You really can't stay. You sure you want to leave? And they're all in this mass exodus of people out. Okay, well, the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Take them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. And anyone of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, shall go with you. And anyone of whom I say to you, this one shall not go with you, shall not go. So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps the water, you shall set by himself. Likewise, everyone who kneels down to drink the water, you're going to put them over there. So he's going to divide them on the basis of how they drink water. And the number of those who lapped the water, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300. But all the rest of the people, would be 9,700 of them, knelt down to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, and I'm sure Gideon did not want to hear this, with the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hand. And let all the others go, every man to his home. Oh, come on, Lord. Come on. Really? 300? Have you seen them, Lord? Have you seen how many there are on the other side? Have you seen them? Wow. But what is really amazing here, which I find this, and I should say, you know, people wonder about, well, what was that test all about? I mean, I wouldn't get hung up on that. Some people think that those who were taking the water without kneeling down were showing more alertness. Others say, no, it's just an arbitrary thing that the Lord did to reduce the number. I don't know that it matters that much. But what I find really encouraging here is that Gideon says nothing to the Lord. He accepts it. And this is where I began to see some hope for him. I began to see a degree of faith that maybe the Lord knows what he's doing. Maybe the Lord knows what he's doing. And he accepts it. And maybe he understands what the Lord said in verse 2 of chapter 7. Verse 2. The people with you are too many to give to the, for me to give the Midianites into your hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand saves me. This is the reason for the reduction of troops, to go from 32,000 to 300. It had to be known that the victory did not rest with the people, but the victory was in the hand of the Lord, and it was the Lord's power to give. The Lord's ability to save his people over the Midianites and the Amalekites was never a problem. But if there was too many people, there would be problems. As he said here, God would not be glorified in this test. God would not be glorified. They would say, we did this. Not the Lord did this. And that's important. It's very important. Because if they begin to think that they did this, then they think that they can save themselves. Then they're not going to trust in the Lord. They're going to trust in themselves. And they're going to rely upon their own ability. And that would be one of the worst things for Israel to do, for the people to do. This would be disastrous. Their confidence must be in the Lord and not themselves. But you know, this is always true for God's people. This is always true for God's people. George Mueller said, there is no glory for God in that which is humanly possible. Faith begins where man's power ends. And he's right. And one of the reasons God puts us in difficult, challenging positions is that his power might be seen. If it's not more than we can do, if it's not beyond our ability, then we just say, well, we did this. But if it's beyond our ability, if it's something that doesn't seem reasonable at all that we could do, and it comes about, then the glory goes to God, and God is honored, and he is seen, rightly seen, as the one who gives the victory. Gideon would go on to celebrate a great victory in the salvation of his people from their enemies. But we celebrate an even greater victory, and that's the victory of Jesus Christ over sin and death. And that is the victory that he won for us. Just like God won the victory over the Amalekites and the Midianites through Gideon, God won the victory over sin and death through Jesus Christ. Had nothing to do with us. There's no way we're going to save ourselves. There's no way we're going to be good enough. There's no way we're going to raise to a spiritual level on our own efforts that is ever going to gain a right standing with God. But God has done this for us. He has provided a salvation for us that is obtained in only one way, and that is by faith, in trusting in Jesus Christ for our salvation. We celebrate this at the Lord's Supper. Gideon struggled in his faith. You see it? There's more we could have talked about, but he struggled. And I think, again, we see that honesty of the scriptures is difficulty. You may be struggling in your faith. You may be struggling to believe in Jesus. You may never have done that. But I would encourage you even today as we prepare for the Lord's Supper that you step out in faith. That you listen to the voice of the Spirit calling you. And that you welcome Jesus Christ into your life. And by faith receive Him. By faith accept His gift. By faith understand that you're a sinner and that Jesus came and died and suffered and died and rose from the dead in order to pay for your sins, pay for my sins. And to welcome that into your life and lay hold of it. And to trust Him. God gave us the Lord's Supper as a reminder of this great thing that He has done for us, for the victory that He has won. It is for all who have believed, whether you've believed this morning or whether you've believed 80 years, 90 years ago. It's for all of us as part of His family. We'll ask those serving to make their way up to the front this morning as we